This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey is off this week. Coming up, the debt ceiling has temporarily been lifted, but Social Security is still on the chopping block, thanks largely to President Obama. And a new study shows that high-tech corporations' campaign contributions are fueling the growth of the national security state. But first, a judge continues to hear testimony in Detroit on whether the city can be forced into bankruptcy by Kevin Orr, the state-appointed emergency financial manager. Michigan's Republican governor claims the state had to take over Detroit because the city lacked the will to tackle its financial problems. But veteran Detroit community activist Deborah Taylor says that's not true.
We have a plan called the Marshall Plan, which Councilmember Joanne Watson commissioned by a professor at Michigan State University and others, that really calls for a very holistic way to create jobs, incorporate the green economy, using HUD Section 3, which calls for dollars that are used for redevelopment, HUD dollars, CDBG dollars, neighborhood stabilization dollars to really be used for contracts, training, and jobs for the communities in which the development is taking place.
And how would that plan deal with Detroit's creditors who seem to be clamoring for a dissolution of Detroit's assets?
I think that if you look back and look at some of the main creditors, there have been bogus, complicated interest rate swaps by banks who've charged hundreds of millions of dollars of interest. And if anything, that needs to be renegotiated. In addition to that, the state changed their formula for revenue sharing. And before the end of this year, we will no longer be able to collect the over $224 million that the state of Michigan owes the city of Detroit. And I haven't heard Mr. Orr call for collection of those dollars, nor the dollars that are owed by some very wealthy business people here in the city that also totals, I think one, it's over $200 million itself. So it's very one-sided, and in terms of trying to protect the banks at the expense of pensioners who really entered a social contract and paid $3 per hour for their tenure working with the city to ensure their pension.
And that's one of the issues that's before the bankruptcy judge now, whether these creditors have a right to claim people's pensions.
Exactly. The reason why this is such a monumental case, one, it's a moral issue, it's a financial issue, but it also, it gets at the core of whether in this democracy, in this capitalistic system, will the system honor its social contract with the people. And I'm prayerful that Judge Rhodes will interpret this in the proper way and see that there's been no good faith effort in negotiations with the unions. The unions came a year before, more than a year before Mr. Orr came on the scene and negotiated with the administration, the Bing administration, and put over $100 million worth of savings on the table. And Governor Snyder prevented the mayor from actually bringing that to city council for a vote. That would have saved over $105 million right there. So it seems as though there's just been a hell-bent intention on getting in the city of Detroit because it has many valuable assets. For example, the water department. When they talk about that $18.5 billion debt, a third of that is already accounted for and paid for by the projected revenues from the water department. But there is a desire to regionalize and take over our water department.
So rather than waiting to get paid a large part of that sum back through the revenues of the water department, they'd rather just take the water department as their own.
That or regionalize it, and it seems as though all the enterprise agencies or those that have the potential to generate revenue are the targets of privatizing and collateralizing rather than looking at a real plan, because we really do have the ability to address our own challenges. It's just a matter of not having proper representation. We have taxation without representation here in the city of Detroit, as well as Flint, as well as Pontiac, as well as Benton Harbor. Their park right along Lake Michigan was taken from them by an emergency manager. And that was given to the people into perpetuity for public, and then they turned it into a PGA golf course. And the average income of a citizen in Benton Harbor is under $10,000, and yet the PGA golf course membership is about $10,000 a year. So it definitely wasn't intended to benefit the people of the city of Benton Harbor.
You spoke of social contracts. Social contracts are difficult to defend in courts of law, and they're usually forged in the streets.
I see it as a moral issue. Detroit is pivotal because over 23,000 retirees in the city of Detroit, if they're in a position to lose their security, to lose their medical care in the golden years of their lives, it's a predictor of what other municipalities around the country can anticipate will happen to them.
Community activist Deborah Taylor speaking from Detroit. President Obama faced down Republicans on the debt ceiling issue, gaining a temporary end to the government shutdown. But the White House and the Republican leadership are in agreement about cutting Social Security and other people's programs. We spoke with Arun Gupta, an independent journalist and co-founder of the Occupied Wall Street Journal. He says President Obama has enabled the whole austerity process that has placed Social Security under assault.
He's the one who has set up these super committees and deficit reduction commissions, the Simpson-Bowles. He came into office in 2009, literally a couple of weeks before he came into office. He gave an interview with the Washington Post. He sat down with their editorial board, and they understood what his agenda was because their headlines said Obama plans to reform entitlements, and that's inside the Beltway speak for cuts of Social Security and Medicare. And he agreed to the sequester. The domestic discretionary spending, especially social welfare, has taken the biggest hits, probably since the Reagan era under his watch. So he's really been pursuing right-wing policies. You know, the difference is, of course, the Tea Party wants to pursue kind of more Dickensian right-wing policies. But nonetheless, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that Obama, by accepting their language, by accepting that somehow the national debt is this huge problem, he legitimizes their worldview and hence pushes the whole discourse to the right instead of offering a vision that is in the interest of what is actually the base of the Democratic Party, working people.
And now that the debt ceiling crisis is temporarily behind us, the train can keep on moving down the track to the grand bargain.
Yeah, that's a good question at this point. The U.S. has become so dysfunctional in terms of the political system, it seems like about the most you can hope for is gridlock. And the animosity is so great between the Republicans and the Obama administration that I think that's become the only saving grace, that it may prevent a grand bargain. I think certainly that's what Obama wants to pursue. It's as I pointed out, he's been wanting to pursue it since before he came into office. You know, one thing I'd like to reference is in September of 2008, as the global markets were melting down and the whole world was teetering on the brink of a new depression, Larry Summers wrote this article in the Financial Times. And so we have to think about it, all the context for this. You have his chief economic advisor writing in the most important capitalist publication in the world at the time of the greatest crisis of capitalism going back to the Great Depression. And what does he recommend? He recommended cutting Social Security and Medicare. And it had nothing to do with the financial crisis, of course. You know, that was all caused by Wall Street. It was all caused by fraud, by the banks, by the subprime mortgage crisis, by the racist lending practices, by lack of oversight, by the rating agencies, by the brokerage firms. And yet they suggested during the height of this crisis that we're going to make working people and retirees pay for this debacle. And that right there is all that you needed to know about the Obama administration agenda. And that has pretty much proven the template for what they've done. They have done a few things, I think, that are a modest benefit, particularly with food stamps, but it's a very thin ledger, a very sparse ledger in terms of any sort of positive achievements for working people in this country.
But Obama and the Republican leadership are in agreement about cutting entitlements, and Obama has put forward his own plan for cutting Social Security.
Yes, I agree that they are in agreement, but there is still is enough of a substantive disagreement. But I think it's more the animosity. And, you know, I don't think we should downplay that. I think often it gets overplayed within mainstream discourse, but clearly the level of how much each side despises each other, I think, has become the only saving grace. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, so maybe somehow within the next couple of years they could come to some sort of a grand bargain. But I think it's less likely than it was a couple of years ago, particularly because they've had all these attempts that have failed already. And the Republicans, of course, I think they are kind of going more and more to greater extremes. You know, they're really this rough party of old white reactionaries at this point. So I think he made it clear that that's what he wants to be part of his legacy. And back in 2009, he made that clear, that this is one thing he hoped to accomplish, was to reform entitlements, basically starve granny, as the parlance goes. And so I think, though, it's less likely now than it was a year or two ago.
Well, yes, that is clear, that not just intransigence from the Tea Party, but real animosity on the part of Republicans has been what's holding up this grand bargain, which Barack Obama has been trying to reach for the longest time. So that, I guess, is why you say the best that we can hope for is gridlock.
Yeah, it's a pretty wretched political state of affairs that we're in. The other thing that I think is very important to recognize, like, basically within the course of a few days, you had articles coming out in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the Atlantic Monthly, you know, three of the leading capitalist media organs in the country, all saying that the Tea Party is out of control and the business community can't control it. And my response is, that is a load. It's like, where do they get that from? Because the best measure of what the quote-unquote business community thinks of what's going on in Washington is the stock market. And the stock market barely budged during the whole crisis. At most, the three major indices, the Dow, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ, only went down about 3%. So there was never any fear that this was going to significantly or even in a small way impact profit-making. So I think for Wall Street, they're perfectly fine on one level with the gridlock. And unfortunately, on a different level for working people, gridlock is about the best they can hope for because it limits the amount of damage that can be done. And this is getting back to the grand bargain. The more the gridlock uneases, the more likely it is that we will see move towards using the Social Security Trust Fund and Medicare to pay for the two wars, the tax cuts, and the massive financial fraud that resulted in the 2008 economic crisis, that all those will be paid off with the money that should be going to working people and retirees.
And austerity totally dominates the political conversation. It dominated the political conversation in 2010, and that was only interrupted quite briefly by the appearance of the Occupy movement.
Yes, Obama in his remarks still talks about needing to deal with the national debt. This is fundamentally absurd. If you really cared about dealing with the debt, austerity is the worst medicine whatsoever. This has no more credibility than medieval bleedings of patients who had anemia. You're prescribing the exact opposite, what is going to kill them, not help them. And this is what austerity does. Instead, the government needs to be priming the pump. That's just logical from a capitalist perspective. They need to be increasing aggregate demand through income transfers, through various programs that get the money in the hands of working people who will spend it and stimulate economic activity. But instead, Obama has endorsed austerity and endorsed using austerity to cut the debt when it has the exact opposite effect. It increases the debt.
Which also goes against the grain of overwhelming public opinion. Most people, polls have shown, don't care about the debt.
Yeah, I think that's one of the other interesting things. There's two ways you can ask questions on this type of subject. When you ask the public, what do they think is the most pressing concern? You can either make it open-ended, which is the best indicator, or you can give them a list. The problem with giving people a list, you're essentially inducing responses. You're planting it in their head. They normally won't think of it as an important idea. So if you give them a list, this is what pollsters have found, of, you know, what do you think is the most pressing issue? Pick one. Jobs, healthcare, the economy, the national debt. When they have the list, about 20% will say national debt. Well, that's still not that great. Overwhelmingly, people still pick jobs, healthcare, or the economy. And when you break down the demographic data, that 20% is essentially the Tea Party, who really cares about the national debt. Now, if you just make it open-ended, the number then falls down to about 4% who list the national debt as the most pressing issue. So this whole concern about the national debt is an inside-the-beltway obsession.
Oh, more than that, it's a corporate and finance capitalist obsession.
Yes, I'm lumping off that altogether, yes. It's a Wall Street obsession, it's a corporate obsession, it's a corporate media obsession, it's the corporate political establishment obsession. They're the ones who are all obsessed by it, not because it's a problem, but because they see this as the best wedge to be able to get their hands on the Social Security Trust Fund. And, you know, let's remember, the Social Security Trust Fund is still solvent for at least 20 years. And, in fact, if it just had one minor tweak where you lift the payroll tax cap, it would be solvent probably in perpetuity.
Which, in fact, makes it so more delicious to the taste of Wall Street.
Exactly. You know, when you're talking about trillions of dollars sitting around, that's a lot of Lamborghinis and $30 million penthouses.
Independent political journalist Arun Gupta. Last week, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network held what they called a national day of protests to stop police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. Carl Dix is a founder of the network and also helped put together Stop, Stop and Frisk 2 years ago, along with Dr. Cornel West. Dick says their efforts have forced traditional black organizations to take a stand against the criminal justice system.
If you go back to 2 years ago and look at the situation, things like stop and frisk were not front burner issues here in New York City. The question of torture in prison was something that hardly anyone knew anything about, let alone said or did much about. And we actually formed the Stop Mass Incarceration Network to transform that, to push these questions front and center. And we thought that waging determined mass resistance was a key part of doing that. That's why we started the Civil Disobedience Campaign here in New York City. And it contributed to, not saying we did it alone, but it did contribute to transforming the terms around that to where stop and frisk became something that you couldn't run for mayor in New York City without talking about. And actually, every one of the Democratic candidates styled themselves as being some sort of opponent of stop and frisk, although they were mostly shucking and jiving. And see, just going forward, this is a battle that is still there and continues to be needs to be taken on, because there's a sense being created that stop and frisk, well, that's over and done with. And what is actually the case is that while the judge ruled that New York's approach to stop and frisk was unconstitutional, she did not say stop and frisk was unconstitutional. And the new mayor coming in, who is likely to be the Democrat Bill de Blasio, has already said that he wants to reform stop and frisk and will set in place an institutional framework for doing that. And see, we have seen this movie before, and in fact, Stop and Frisk itself was a reform of heinous police practicing by the New York Police Department from the Street Crimes Unit, which murdered Amadou Diallo in a hail of 43 shots. When that got exposed, they said, okay, we'll come with a better approach. We'll come with something that won't be like that. And they came up with Stop and Frisk, which continued, intensified, and spread what people were against to start with. So we can't sit back, and we don't intend to sit back and just let them put in place whatever they're going to do and then see how it goes. We're going to continue to take the thrust of stopping Stop and Frisk into their reform process.
You in the Stop, Stop, and Frisk movement have put numbers of people on the street, sometimes large numbers, sometimes less. Some of us speculate that the dramatic fall off in black street demonstration activity over the past decades is because so many young black folks are caught up in the criminal justice system and can't afford to present themselves to the police in demonstrations.
Yes, that's actually a very real factor. We knew that was the case when we initiated the campaign around Stop and Frisk. And when you step back and look at it, the whole program of intensifying the policification of the inner cities, passing laws that target inner city blacks and Latinos, like the cocaine sentencing disparity, the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine, with the Obama administration reduced to 18 to 1, even though there is no scientific, moral, or legal basis for there to be any distinction between those two forms of cocaine. They only reduced it to 18 to 1, pulled the knife back out a few inches. After they'd stuck it in your back 6 inches, they pulled it out a couple and said, okay, is everything cool now? You know, just to borrow a Malcolm X thing on it. But we understood that what was going on was that the rulers of this country remembered the 1960s and what young black people did then in standing up to all of the mess that was being brought down on black people and how that sparked off a revolutionary movement that was broader and knocked the whole system back on its heels. They're trying to get ahead of the curve this time, coming down on especially the young people, to keep them from being in position to stand up and resist. So what we have to do is we have to bring forward people who feel like they are in position, which includes some of the inner city black people who have not yet been hit, because a brother who took some arrests with us, one of the points that he made was like, I'm a young black man with a clean record, have not yet been arrested. But it is likely that I will be arrested today because I'm in this protest against Stop and Frisk. That's what he said before we went to the precinct in Harlem. And he was right, they did arrest him. But then also going to people who don't face this policification all day, every day, 24/7, and saying to them, do you want to live in a world where this happens to people because of the color of their skin? Challenging some of them to come out, getting professors. We even got a lawyer to get arrested with us, and people in New York were telling me when I was doing this, do not ask any lawyers to get arrested with you because no lawyer will ever get arrested. Well, the widow of William Kunstler, Margaret Ratner Kunstler, came out not just to be our attorney, but to get arrested with us, and I have to salute the sister for doing that.
Studies have shown that compared to 40 years ago, young black people with a college education are less likely to serve time in prison today, while blacks without a college education are more likely to serve time in prison at some point in their lives, pointing up what appears to be a widening class differential in terms of the criminal justice system and its consequences.
Yes, that differential you're pointing out is real, and it figures into the strategic approach of the authorities because they want to create a minority section among black people that has the basis to view itself as more stakeholders in the setup, and then hoping that that section will be a buffer that helps them to keep those people who still pushed down and pushed even further down from standing up and going at the real source of the problem, the capitalist imperialist system. So that's another thing that we have to take into account in going about this, because we have to appeal to even black youth who are on the college success track of, are they going to stand by and let this happen? And there were several sisters, young black women from Columbia University, who came out and got arrested in the protest, and who pretty much said, look, we understand we're on the track to succeed in this system and become cogs in a machine that's grinding up our brothers and sisters. We reject that path. So we need to be working to bring that forward, because as that is brought forward, it gives heart to the people who live their lives under the guns and billy clubs of these brutal murdering cops, because they understand they're not alone in this battle and that they can stand up, they can speak out, and they can join the resistance. And, you know, as a revolutionary communist, I'm working on bringing all of this together in the framework of a movement for revolution that can get at the heart of this problem, the capitalist imperialist system, and get rid of it through revolution.
So what's the next big event or project in the fight against mass incarceration and its feeder systems like Stop and Frisk?
Okay, well, in relation to mass incarceration overall, the prison hunger strike, torture in prison issue, we are moving to do another round of publishing of an ad with hundreds of signatories calling for an end to torture in prison. It's the emergency call. At the same time, the plan to move on Stop and Frisk, it hasn't taken shape in terms of the dates and things like that, because they're going to set up a series of hearings in New York City. And the message of cease and resist, stop and frisk is going to be brought into those hearings. And as soon as we learn when they are, then we're going to have our plan to move in them. And then at the same time, we have a benefit, because as you know, Glenn, from looking at the experience of the black struggle in this country, freedom ain't free. So we got a benefit coming up on November the 22nd in New York City at the National Black Theater. It's going to be headlined by Brother Arturo O'Farrell of the Afro-Latin Jazz Alliance.
And how do we get in touch with you at the Stop and Frisk and Stop Mass Incarceration movements?
We're collecting reports on October 22nd. This will be displayed at the website stopmassincarceration.net. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, .net. So get in touch, get involved.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. A new study shows that President Obama's enthusiasm for domestic and international spy programs has a lot to do with the campaign contributions of high-tech corporations that profit from the national surveillance state. Dr. Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts at Boston, explains the study's findings.
It's telling you that the national surveillance state is not simply a question of individual politicians' ideologies or bureaucrats' ideologies. It's really a giant interest group issue. And there's a serious block of folks who, I'm sorry to say, profit off this stuff. And then if you've got folks making big profits in America, there's usually some of them being recycled into politics. That's what we demonstrate. I was particularly struck by a little analysis I read by somebody not long after the vote on the, remember the House vote that came up that almost passed to put some restrictions on the NSA. It was a mix of liberal Democrats and so-called libertarians or Tea Party people at the time they were being called that. And it barely lost, but somebody ran an analysis that showed it was a sort of quick but not dirty analysis that sort of suggested that there was a strong correlation between the folks voting in support of the NSA and the amount of defense and what they were calling surveillance industry cash. Now, they probably didn't have a perfect indicator of that, because I know this data pretty well. But they had a good one, and they showed that the correlation was very strong between guys voting to keep the policy as it was and the amount of that cash in their district. That was sobering to me. That was pretty interesting. And my colleagues and I had been working on an analysis of the 2012 election, and when the Snowden stuff hit, with from Greenwald and the Washington Post and all that, we just looked at that and said, this is really very interesting, because these are the industries that we'd already identified as uniquely among the business community, really friendly to Obama, with a very high percentage of support known for him, either the firms or the executives, because, you know, you can do both. You have to be a little careful in this environment, thanks to the Supreme Court. Lots of ways money goes into politics.
So the surveillance state is a growth market for this sector of big business.
Yeah, and what's really just, and what it's chilling to me a little bit too, I mean, if you start thinking about, well, how do you fix this situation? Well, what you've actually got is now you got a system dominated by firms that want to sell all your data, working with a government that wants to collect nearly all of it through them. And that's the kind of sort of nexus that's formed around the political leadership in Washington. And we all know the national security state, way antedated, Bush and Cheney, but they blew it up to enormous proportions after 9/11. And we, you know, everybody thought that when Obama came in, he'd probably rein it in. He was talking like he was going to do it, and they did do something. I mean, the very worst abuses, and I hope there are no more Abu Ghraibs out there, which incidentally was itself the fruits of privatization. They were interrogation is privatized in this new national surveillance state. I mean, as Tim Shorrock says in his blended book, there, Spies for Hire, about 2/3 of all the intelligence budgets now just goes right out of the government into private sector firms. That's also why a lot of it goes badly. I mean, their standards to these folks they are held to and things like that are not very high. And what's even more troubling is a lot of the folks who pushed privatization of the national security state back, you know, in the 90s and early years of this century, those are the folks who now lead it. What our post, it's actually an alternate. And then there's a long version up on the Roosevelt Institute website. And it's about the interest group constellation that is now formed around, you know, the national surveillance state. I confess I had not been sufficiently awake on this. I knew there were problems, but, you know, I thought they were mostly Bush and Cheney problems, and then that's clearly wrong.
There used to be a school of thought that felt that these high-tech industries would be endangered. The growth of them might be endangered by the national security or surveillance state, that they would be absorbed by the government. But it seems it's the other way around.
The other way around. Yeah, you show me the case. I mean, I know people are all the time talking about big government. Let's face it, especially in the last 30 or 40 years, you're talking about big business, although some of these firms are not huge in terms of the Fortune 500, but many of them are.
You're saying that your analysis provides a good rationale for why Obama has behaved in the way he has done, despite the fact that these surveillance policies are very unpopular among his electoral base.
I do think that that's an important part of why that happens. I have no inside information. I do bump into people who've been to meetings with Obama, and one of them said to me, you know, he'd come into a meeting with him and just flatly told him that all this stuff about the national, he didn't use the term, the national surveillance state was just way overblown, that it was just really not a problem. And certainly the steps he's taken, like he has that commission up, which is supposed to look at this, nobody thinks that commission has people on it who are going to do very much. It seems clear that the administration is not taking this seriously. It's about as serious as they took their promises to further card check and unionization, if you remember that one. Here, we're a long way from any serious reform. I mean, Senator Wyden the other day was talking about the failure of the reform impulse thus far, and I think he's right.
I suppose the lesson from your studies is that we have been warned for many decades about the military-industrial complex. We should be also on the lookout for an emerging military-industrial surveillance complex.
That's exactly right. That's why we use that term, the national surveillance state. We're in a new era here, you know. I mean, probably in the past, some of our folks in government, one thinks only of J. Edgar Hoover, right? If they had the technical ability to do it, you know that J. Edgar Hoover would have done it. But they didn't have the technical ability. Now they do. They can get and store just about everything. This is a new ball game, and it brings in, because of the way electronics develops, it rolls in a much larger chunk of the business community than you normally think of as national defense.
We've had presidents and parties who were said to be from the oil fields or from Wall Street. Now we're talking about one who might be called from Silicon Valley.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think the Obama vision of the future of America is very much a sort of high-tech industrialist with an admixture of financial interest view. I think that's when you start looking at all this talk about modernizing the state, smart investments and stuff like that. That's what you're seeing.
Dr. Thomas Ferguson of the University of Massachusetts at Boston. The team at Black Agenda Report is still aglow from our 7th anniversary celebration at New York's historic Riverside Church. One of the speakers was Maurice Carney of Friends of Congo. Carney said the Democratic Republic of Congo is arguably the richest country on the planet, with resources valued at perhaps $24 trillion. And that's why the West has been so ruthless in keeping Congo subservient.
Why does Congo matter? Because it's central to the future of the African continent. That's why Che Guevara went there in 1965, because he saw it as a front against imperialism and felt that victory had to be won in the Congo, and said Congo's problem was not just a Congolese problem or an African problem, but he said it was a world problem. We saw Nkrumah at the same time writing The Challenge of the Congo, because he saw Congo as the capital for his Pan-African project of the United States of Africa. Fanon said, the fate of all of us is at stake in the Congo. So if we look at our revolutionaries, freedom fighters, Malcolm X always spoke about the Congo. If you watch his debate at Oxford, the overwhelming majority of his debate at Oxford was about the Congo. So Congo is central to the future of the African continent. It's the first place in which the United States in post-independence Africa intervened. And they developed a policy they call the Congo Syndrome. And that policy has been applied throughout the African continent. The Congo has been destabilized since its inception. And most recently, after the United States had imposed Mobutu on the Congolese people for over 3 decades, and they got tired of him, instead of supporting a pro-democracy movement inside of the country, the Clinton administration backed a war of aggression by U.S. proxies, Rwanda and Uganda, in 1996. That triggered the deaths of an estimated 6 million people. The United Nations says it's the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II, but yet we hardly hear about it. Our sister said, remaining silent is no longer an option. That's why Black Agenda Report decided to break the silence and give me a platform here tonight, and have been giving me a platform and Friends of the Congo platform for the last few years. Those proxies of the United States that invaded the Congo, led by Paul Kagame of Rwanda and Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Susan Rice, who was then Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, dubbed these leaders the new breed of African leaders, Renaissance leaders. And what they all had in common is they came into power with the barrel of a gun, they invaded another African country, they're authoritarian figures, they have the blood of millions of Africans on their hands, and they formed a beachhead of neoliberal policies in the heart of Africa. You're going to find Kagame at Davos next to Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, not at the World Social Forum. So, these leaders who have waged war against the Congolese people and civilians in the Great Lakes of Africa could not have done what they've done without the backing of the United States. The United States has provided them with arms, provided them with training, military equipment, financing, intelligence, and when their crimes are brought up at the international level and accountability is called for, the United States runs interference and provides them with diplomatic and political cover. So those crimes that are being committed in the Congo could not be committed without the backing of the United States and the protection of their allies, Rwanda and Uganda. That's why I gotta give props to Vijay Prashad, who recently wrote an article comparing Gaza to Congo. Because the same protection that the United States gives to Israel and its actions in Palestine is the same protection it gives to Rwanda and Uganda and their actions in the Congo. So why does Congo matter? Because it's trapped in a geostrategic battle for natural resources. It's coltan is vital to precision instruments in fighter jets, night vision goggles that the United States military uses. Its cobalt is key for the U.S. aerospace and military industries. Uranium, I've already stated. It's a storehouse of strategic minerals that are vital to major industries in the West, whether we're talking about a technology industry, electronics industry, automotive industry, jewelry industry. Congo has the minerals that are vital to those industries. So that's why Congo matters. President Obama, when he was senator, he understood this to some degree. He passed a law. One of his signature achievements as senator was to pass a law on the Congo called the Democratic Republic of Congo Release Security and Democracy Promotion Act that called on the United States Secretary of State to withhold aid to any country that destabilized the Congo, meaning Rwanda and Uganda. As president, he hasn't acted on it. It's a major contradiction. He was interviewed earlier this year and asked about intervening in Syria. Brother Ajimu talked about the responsibility to protect. Samantha Power and Ambassador Rice are the two major proponents of that in the Obama administration. And President Obama said that, how do I make a decision whether to intervene in the Congo or intervene in Syria? If the interviewer knew Obama's policy in the Congo and understand the situation, he knew that it wasn't a matter of U.S. intervening militarily, but using its diplomatic tools that was enshrined in U.S. law that calls on the United States Secretary of State to withhold aid from any nation destabilizing the Congo. The reason it's not implemented is because U.S. allies are the ones who are doing the destabilizing in Rwanda and Uganda. So that's a contradiction that exists in the Obama administration and in the Congo. So when people talk about Syria and those who are dying in Syria, or when Susan Rice made the argument to intervene in Libya because thousands were dying, we had to rightly ask, how can you call for military action in Syria and Libya when we're talking about thousands, when you're not even willing to take diplomatic action in the Congo when we're talking about millions? So the responsibility to protect Congo is center. If we're talking about the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II, we take Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Bosnia, put them all together, Rwanda genocide, they do not match the deaths that occurred in the Congo. So we're talking about human life and our response to the Congo and the millions of deaths, lives lost. Our response to that says how much we value black life, how much we value African life, how much we value human life. We're silent because we don't value those black lives. So breaking your silence is a way of demonstrating value for black life. And Black Agenda values black life, values African life, values human life. And that's why they provided this platform. And I'm grateful and thank you for this opportunity and for being here today.
Maurice Carney of Friends of Congo. Actor and political activist Danny Glover recently spoke in Benton Harbor, Michigan, where Reverend Edward Pinckney is leading community resistance to a state takeover of the mostly black town. Danny Glover said people should not be afraid to change the world we live in.
Because when you talk about changing something, radically changing something that changes all the things that we think about, all the ways in which we perceive our lives were to be. And it changes something else. We have to come up with new language. We have to reimagine ourselves within the language and within the framework of the change that's necessary. And we don't know what it's going to look like. To say that we're going to know what it looks like, it's incongruent with what happens with real change. I don't know. As I sit here and think about it, I've had the opportunity over the last few years to spend a great deal of time in Latin America and watch what is happening in Latin America. And from talking to my friends, whether they're economists or whether they're thinkers or artists or involved in other social endeavors, to find out what is happening in here. Because we have a very interesting construct here. We have states which have elected officials in most of these countries. Most of those officials are to the left of the previous regimes. And what they begin to do is say, how do we utilize resources to benefit our community? How do we take the oil that we have in one country and use that oil to create free universities, to use the money for that oil to expand public education, to use that money from that oil to expand the whole idea of art and music to communities that don't have access to art and communities, or to use that money to expand its health care and to set another relationship and template for what do we mean by development. Yet we're going to have contradictions within that itself, because within those contradictions, there's also the system that defines itself by profit. The Workers' Party in Brazil, an extraordinary feat. The Workers' Party was developed, was organized, but one of its presidents, its first presidents, one of its first presidents to come from that was a man who had not graduated from college, had very little public education, and yet he formed the Workers' Party. And within the framework of that Workers' Party, the Workers' Party, it did save the country from collapse, because the system that it worked under, in which it exploited, and eviscerated the middle class, became unsustainable. So what did they do? They changed the whole idea with social programs, with redefining the space and creating other space for people to act as citizens. And creating that space, they also created new contradiction, because those who had power were only going to allow them to define that change within a certain range and a certain paradigm. And then they were going to have to struggle right there. So those countries are dealing with that. It's a place that we hadn't gotten to. It's a place that where political power is used to such a point, and you have such expression in change, real change, not the change that we pretend we want to, but real change. Real change. So we have said, well, where do we hear? Where do we define ourselves? Where do we look at these places where we do this? The poor country, the poor continent of Africa is devastated. Devastated by colonialism, devastated before that by slavery, devastated by neocolonialism, and devastated by internal conflicts right at this moment. Whether we're talking about Sudan, or we're talking about Somalia, or whether we're talking about Nigeria, or whether we're talking wherever we talk about, you know. And most of us have been around to watch. We saw the promise of Angola and Mozambique. Most of us here who saw that after their independence, after the overthrow of the Portuguese dictatorship in 1975. Great promise. Angola was the third leading oil producer on the continent. Angola was. It had the largest civil service sector of any of the countries in the former Portuguese colonies. And yet it was devastated purposefully by an internal civil war that has left more amputees per capita than any place in the world. That's what happened in Angola. We watched that. So we watched the opportunity right on our watch as that happened to this country. And that has found its way. So the guns that end up in Libya with Gaddafi's overthrow, and I'm not justifying Gaddafi, end up in Mali, end up in Somalia, end up in places in the world, other places in the world. And we watch that continue. So the chance of Africa rekindling its whole spirit becomes diminished every day as it goes through a process of recolonization around its vital resources, because it still has resources. 3 million men and women in the Congo, and yet no one talks about it. No one speaks about it. So those are the kind of questions that are outside of our own position. But how do they relate to us? They relate to us by understanding the beast, the animal that we're dealing with, by understanding exactly what is intended. Let's look at this. If Benton Harbor was a prosperous place with 45,000 citizens in it 40, 50 years ago, what were the elements that went into that? Jeremy Rifkin wrote a book 20 years ago called The End of Work. He said that in a very interesting chapter on black labor, he said that it was not the Emancipation Proclamation that freed black people from the land, it was the invention of the cotton picking machine. It was the invention of the cotton picking machine. That means in 1944, when the cotton picking machine was invented, 100% of the cotton was picked by hand. Within 25 years, 100% of the cotton was picked by machine. Meaning in an exodus of more than 5 million African Americans from the South, where? To places like Benton Harbor, to Detroit, Michigan, to Pittsburgh, to other places where they can find work and jobs and everything. And found those jobs too. I remember one of my first girlfriends when I was 19 years old. She was from Detroit, Michigan. And she had grown up in a house where her father worked in the auto industry. They owned the house. They raised the family. He had a job that was living wage that allowed him to raise a family, live there, everything else. But today, is that possible in Detroit, Michigan? So it was that drove African Americans out of the South, took them to these urban centers, now being alienated from the land, ended up in these urban cities as cheap labor or labor, and then become alienated from each other and themselves. And they said, that process, how do we reverse that process? And that's to say we can't reverse it. We can't go back to 1955 or 1956 or whatever time or 1960. We have to move from here at this particular moment where we are. And what are the things we need to do? We need to find and talk about education in real terms. We need to preserve the integrity of the public system, a system that was developed and ideas that came out of people like Dewey at the turn of the century and other educators. All those who talked about education and public education and the poor. And we need to make education, educate our children to be functional citizens. Thank you. That becomes the first thing. We need to talk about food security. Right over in Detroit, right here in Detroit, is the home of urban gardening. And people from around the world come to Detroit and talk about urban gardening. Talk about that. See what the kind of things are. Need to talk about food security. And we need to find ways in which we really develop businesses, entrepreneurship in any way that is connected to communities. McDonald's not connected to our community. Starbucks is not connected to our community. When we had businesses that were connected to our community, there was a protest and people stood up from those businesses to be part of what was happening. We need to talk about all those things. At the same time, we need to invigorate the idea of democracy and what it is. Alexis de Tocqueville, the great French historian and philosopher, more than 175 years ago, he said this right here is a very interesting process, this whole thing about democracy. But it's important that what makes it function as people are informed and seek information outside of Fox News, CNN, and other things like that. But not only that, but they're active in the process. Without it, it doesn't become that. And when it's active, and you've seen those communities when people say, we won't know what we want, we just what we're going to get, and this is how we're going to get it, you know? This is what we say. A. Philip Randolph said, there are no seats at the banquet table of nature. Thank you. There are no seats. You know, you come there and you get what you need. You get what you, and you protect what you get. I'm paraphrasing. And you take and you organize to protect. So you need to organize. You need to talk about that. And talk about organizing in a real sense. Talk about ideas. They don't have to be the ideas that somebody else promotes. They don't have to be the ideas that the president, even though he's black, may want you to promote. They have to be your ideas. What makes this function? Those have to be, those are the centerpiece. And it's all of us. It's all of us.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.